And I would like now, in fact, I'm delighted to welcome back to the show Bill DeBuise. He's an award-winning author, conservationist, author of 7 books, longtime New Mexican, and he's here with us in the Santa Fe Bacon Company. Thank you so much for coming down.
Oh, it's always a pleasure to be with you, Mary Charlotte.
So you are, thanks to our beloved Lois Rudnick, who is a board member here at KSFR, you are being raffled off. I hate to say it that way, but it is true. If anybody gives during this hour a donation of $25 or more and would like to have lunch with Bill DeBuise, you get to be in a drawing and the lucky person gets to go to lunch with you.
Oh boy, I'm all set.
So the number, if you want to get involved with that, or if you just simply want to make a contribution to KSFR in any amount, is 505-428-1393, 428-1393. And we have a goal this hour, as we do most hours, or as I do most hours, of $1,000. And so let's get the phones ringing and bring $1,000 in to KSFR to make this station basically viable for another 6 months, which is about how much time passes between our fund drives.
Well, absolutely. And I just want to say, Mary Charlotte, I'm delighted to be able to lend a hand. I love KSFR, and I love your show, and I'm very glad to have a chance to be a little bit of help, I hope.
Well, thank you, and I love having you on the show. You've been on a lot in recent years. Well, I've been doing this for 10 years now, and each time you have a book, and sometimes you have an event, and we talk to you about what's going on in New Mexico and what's going on in the world. And one of the distinctions that we have on the Radio Cafe is we are the radio station on planet Earth that has had the most broadcasts about the Sao La.
That's right. This is Sao La International Radio right here. This is where it began.
And you may, ladies and gentlemen, ask, what is Sao La?
The Sao La is a very beautiful and very rare creature that lives in the mountains that divide Laos and Vietnam. And the first radio show that mentioned Sao La was Mary Charlotte's Radio Cafe right here from the Santa Fe Bacon Company when we had Bill Robichaux, a marvelous conservation biologist here.
The world's leading expert on Sao La.
And the coordinator of the IUCN's Sao La Working Group. And in 2011, I went on an expedition with the marvelous Mr. Robichaux into Sao La habitat, and I'm glad to say that I survived the experience and have come away and have been working on a book about that expedition and about this marvelous animal, which is a large animal. It can weigh up to 100 kilos, 220 pounds. It's a mammal. It's a ruminant, a bovid. It seems...
That means cow-like.
Cow-like, yes. And the Sao La seems to have branched off from the family tree of ruminants way back when wild cattle, on the one hand, and antelopes and goats, on the other hand, diverged. And so we're talking 5 to 20 million years ago, this creature came forth. And it has been completely unknown to Western science. It was completely unknown to Western science until 1992.
Right.
So we've only been aware in this country of the existence of Sao La for 21 years or 22 years.
And I think it's significant that, of course, the Sao La has not been unknown. It's just been unknown to science. It's very well known, although sort of mysterious and mythological, and you can talk about that, but it's been well known to the actual people, villagers and so on, who live in the area where its habitat is.
That's right. And, you know, this is some of the most remote country in Southeast Asia. And the people who live in those communities don't have a lot of contact with the rest of the world. And so we had the experience of going in and talking to people about Sao La, and we would be asked, well, are there Sao La in America? No. Are there Sao La in India? No. Are there Sao La in Africa? No. There are only Sao La right here where you live.
And how did they react to that?
They would be stunned. Stunned. And in many instances, they would be inspired with a sense of pride that they had in their part of the world something that was truly unique and something that the rest of the world didn't have. And then when we followed it up with the idea that, well, you really shouldn't set snares that could take a sowlaw, and you shouldn't shoot them when your dogs corner them, because there just aren't that many left, they'd say, that's right. If I come to a sowlaw, I won't shoot it anymore.
Now, were they shooting them?
Yes, on the rare occasions when they would encounter them. It was just another animal of the forest, not a frequently encountered one, but it added to the diversity of the stew pot once in a while.
Wow.
Yeah.
And so they are so rare that the world's leading expert on them has never seen one.
Has never seen one in the wild. Bill Robichaux spent 2 weeks with one that had been captured. That was back in 1996. And he's really the only Westerner who's been able to observe a sowlaw in detail under any circumstances.
So one of the things that happened, and I told this story once before, but it's just been very moving to me, is that Bill Robichaux, who used to come to Santa Fe once a year, he would come and he and I and you, Bill DeBuis, who were writing this book, would basically do a radio show about it. And the first time I was learning what this creature was, and it's a beautiful creature. It's the closest thing to a unicorn, even though it has two horns. But other than that, it's like a living, breathing unicorn out in the woods that's very shy, and nobody has ever seen it, or almost nobody's ever seen it. And they're trying to take pictures of it, and it eludes everybody who's looking for it. And every year there's an update, because of course it is so critically endangered that there may not even be any of them left, but we're hoping there are, maybe there are. So Robichaux takes the podcast of the Santa Fe Radio Cafe and brings it to a conservation organization, and this animal, the sowlaw, is made Animal of the Year for fundraising for that organization.
Yes, I think it was the Northern European Association of Zoos or something like that.
Yeah.
And so podcasts of Radio Cafe shows about sowlaw, of which there have been three or four now, have been passed all around the globe.
It's unbelievable.
Yeah.
It makes me so sort of proud and happy and just amazed at the power of radio.
Yes.
428-1393 is the number. If you believe in radio and if you like radio out there in radio land basically means your car, or your house, or your studio, or your workplace, or your, what do you call that thing? The thing on your headphones from your computer, your stream. That is Radio Land. So if you, ladies and gentlemen out there in Radio Land, believe in the power of radio and like the Radio Cafe, whether you listen to it in the morning or now in the afternoon, we would ask you to please give a call, 428-1393, and make a contribution to this show. Bill DeBuis has given us the tremendous privilege of letting us spend an hour together conversing about the land, wildlife, cultural life, and everything else that affects the planet that we are living on together. And he will gladly go out to lunch with a lucky one of you. And the phone is ringing. Let's keep the phone ringing. We're looking for $1,000 this hour, 428-1393.
Let's have lunch.
Let's have lunch with Bill DeBuis. Now, and if somebody wants me to come along, I will, but I don't have to. But I like being here.
We absolutely want you to come along.
I don't have to come along. Whatever the lucky listener wants, that's it. So, but let's, let's talk about New Mexico. You've lived here for what, 40 years? 35 years?
Yeah, 40 years. Yeah, 41 years.
And, oh, by the way, I've been told to mention that the reason I'm on at 4 today instead of 5 is because we've got the city council meeting at 5. So 5 o'clock is the slot where the Journey Home has been for so many years in the past, and the Radio Cafe is broadcasting during the 5 to 6 hour, but I'm on today at 4 because of the city council. So, you've been in New Mexico for 40 years. How have you seen the land change for the better, for the worse, for the different?
Well, certainly in that time, New Mexico has grown physically a lot. I mean, I remember when I first got to Santa Fe, the limit of the city going south on Cerrillos Road was Denny's. That was the last thing.
That's right.
And now it goes a mile or two past that point.
So you didn't have the Yucca Drive-In?
Oh, and the Yucca Drive-In was there then, and I adored the Yucca Drive-In. I mean, it should have been left as a kind of monument.
Yeah, with that just crazy awesome sign in the front.
And the incredibly phallic
exactly.
Yucca out there. It was really a sight to see. And at that time, St. Michael's Drive was this... was a new road. It was kind of on the periphery. There wasn't much happening along there. So Santa Fe, and back then, my golly, around the plaza, you could get a haircut, you could buy a book, you could. There was a pharmacy. You could buy a cheap shirt. You could, buy a bag of nails if you wanted to from Sears, just a half a block down Lincoln.
Yeah, it was really like
a
Main Street
town.
USA.
Yeah, very much so.
But you've lived really out on the land. You live up near Peñasco?
Yes, I live in a village called El Valle, which is near Las Trompas.
That's right.
On the road between Truchas and Peñasco. And up there, things haven't changed so much.
Is that right?
There's certainly change, but not really graphic, fast-paced change. Although... we see more and more change in the forests now. You know, in the 1970s, nobody talked about forest health as an issue. Nobody was worried about outbreaks of bark beetles. And certainly in those days, catastrophic fires were not on the horizon at all. I remember I was a firefighter. I was a Peñasco Tortuga back in those days. And in 1977... I was called up to fight this gigantic fire over by Los Alamos, which was the La Mesa fire. This is 1977. And La Mesa scared everybody half to death. It burned something like 14,000 acres, which today we look at and say, well, that's just a middling-sized fire.
It's right.
So our whole scale of understanding what's going on in the... and being concerned about what's going on in the forest is totally different today.
I read a book of yours some years ago called River of Traps, which was a collaboration with the wonderful Alex Harris,
yes,
who's a photographer. And the two of you have been here and been together and really living and getting to know this land in a very profound way for so long. And one of the things that was a takeaway for me from that book was... it deromanticized working the land. Working the land is hard.
Yes. Yes, it's hard and it's messy a lot. I mean, there are scenes in there I remember about helping our neighbor Jacobo Romero with his cattle, which involved the dehorning and the castration and the slitting of the ears and the inoculations for red water and other diseases and all that kind of stuff. It was kind of a messy business.
And it made you understand why his kids wanted to go off and do other things.
Yeah, some of them did. Not all of them did. He had quite a few kids. But and his son, actually, Lalo Olivario, who took up much the same life that his father had done. He was the oldest of the family. He, in turn, became a very, very dear friend over the years as a neighbor. But you're quite right. A lot of his kids moved on, went to other places, and his family was spread all over the United States.
Yeah.
In the end, and Jacobo and his wife Eliza would travel often to go and see them, and it was a very big expanding of the world for them as time went on.
There's such an interesting dialectic, I think, between on the one hand wanting to really put roots down in a place and have your children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren know the land the way you do, work the land, have a relationship to the land. And then this other thing, which is becoming more cosmopolitan, which has a lot of advantages in terms of getting rid of perhaps one's prejudices, getting to know how other people live, opening one's minds to other ways of life, and that the kind of mixing that happens when you no longer have a continuity of generations is such a double-edged sword.
It is. But, most of the parents there in El Valle, they very actively encouraged their kids to get out of the village, to go get an education, to see the world, to learn a profession or trade. And what's interesting now is to see some of those people whom I knew when they were young, when I was young, coming back to the village to retire, having spent their lives out there in the larger world. But they still know where home is, and the kind of, I don't know, beauty and just good feeling that there is to be close to the ground in a place as spectacularly lovely as El Valle.
428-1393 is the number here. We're talking to Bill Dubuis, author of many books, and he is offering himself, so to speak, for lunch.
This is getting more interesting all the time.
excuse me. No, it's, if you make a very modest contribution to KSFR, you can be, if you want to be, and you have to specify it when you talk to the folks at the on the phone, you can be put in a raffle, and one lucky listener will be able to have lunch with Bill at the Zia Diner, which is, has really good food, I think. 428-1393. Somebody told me the other day that if you live in Brazil and you emigrate, you go away, and then you come back to retire, they'll give you a pension because it's a reward for having had to make the sacrifice of not being in Brazil all your life.
Oh, what a thought. Isn't that an interesting concept? Yeah. Yeah.
So, 428-1393. What kind of changes have you seen in the way that people are using the land where you live? Are there a lot of the same people, the same families, growing the same kinds of things on their land, using it in the same way?
Well, actually, there's a lot less livestock in the village, a lot less cattle, I should say. There may be a fairly constant number of horses, but the ranching activity where I'm most familiar with it is a lot less today than it was. And part of that is because of the changing character and relationship with the Forest Service. It's more and more difficult for a rancher to operate a Forest Service grazing permit. And the economics of small-scale family farm kind of ranching are just brutally difficult. So we're seeing a good deal less of cattle in the area.
I have very little understanding of the economics of that, but it does occur to me that suppose you had a few cows and each year you butchered whatever number you needed to get through the winter and to get through the year, that's a lot of protein.
Yes, it is.
You can your vegetables and your fruits, and I mean, just the apricots on one tree on my street seems like it would feed an entire village. That's not entirely true, but, you know, there's a lot of fruit.
In a good year, there
is. In a good year.
And for instance, this year, we haven't had any fruit to speak of. It's been a really tough one. So, you know, there are all those unknowns and vagaries and lots of change and chance at work. But the bottom line is that if you're trying to take care of 8 or 10 cows and you hope you have 2 or 3 calves or yearlings each year that you can butcher one, you take 2 to the sale barn, you get a little cash, etc. That kind of operation still requires inputs of a big stout pickup truck, a trailer, and so forth. And the amount of money it takes to just stay equipped and find the grazing and all that kind of stuff can be pretty difficult. Plus, it takes a lot of labor, and so everybody has to think, well, is my labor going to be as well rewarded doing that as if I did this other thing and you know, a job for cash, that kind of thing.
428-1393 is the number. I'm not getting a lot of messages from the control room, which tells me that the phone is not exactly ringing off the hook. So let's get it going. 428-1393. I think it's actually very quiet this hour. So let's get it going. Let's get it moving. 428-1393, the KSFR Fun Drive, Bill Dubuis. Let's talk about climate change. You wrote this wonderful book called A Great Aridness, which is about climate change, which is about drought, which is about the Southwest. How has that book been received, and what has been the journey that you and that book have taken since you wrote it?
Well, I think the book has been quite well received. I mean, it it seems still to be selling. It gets talked about. I've certainly had a lot of invitations to go places and give talks based on it. All of this tells me that there's an enormous amount of worry and anxiety out there about climate change and about what it's going to do to our region in particular, which is particularly vulnerable to it because we're already dry, we're already warm. Getting drier and warmer can flip us over certain thresholds that make it tougher to sustain ourselves here.
What are some of those thresholds?
Well, we are already over-allocated in terms of water. And so if, as the models predict, if stream flow declines significantly because of not necessarily less precipitation, but just greater heat, greater warmth, which increases evaporation, so there's less water on the land available to run in our rivers and streams and accumulate in reservoirs and so forth, we're looking at a drier future. And for a part of the world that's already water stressed, getting it more stressed means people are going to have to give it up here or there. And people may wind up suffering. We saw a lot of that this summer.
What did it look like?
Well, the Carlsbad Irrigation District, for instance, its canals were just bone dry for most of the summer. And Carlsbad was sort of arguing and wrestling with Roswell over who was abusing whose water rights. Texas is suing New Mexico over groundwater pumping in the lower Rio Grande area below Elephant Butte, saying that groundwater pumping in that area, Hatch on down through Mesilla, is depriving Texas of stream flow that is belongs to Texas by right of the Rio Grande Compact. And so Texas has appropriated $5 million to litigate this against New Mexico in the Supreme Court. And everybody's waiting to see if the Supreme Court accepts the case. And so we've got these kinds of stresses. There was a point this summer when Elephant Butte, our largest reservoir, was effectively dry. And it was officially down to 3% of capacity.
Good heavens.
So this year was a very dry year. Yes, indeed. In fact, the previous 12 months were the driest 12 months in New Mexico since records have been kept, which takes us, goes back 100 years or 120 years or so. But the fact is that with climate change, this may be not, in a sense, a drought. This may be the new normal.
The new normal.
And so if that's the case, we are going to have to change a lot of the things that we do, a lot of the arrangements that we have. And we're going to have to see some of the water that presently goes to agriculture redirected to cities and industries. And we're going to see in the agricultural world one agricultural district in many instances pitted against another, as was the case between Carlsbad and Roswell last summer.
We're talking to Bill DeBuise. The phones have been just painfully slow. So, ladies and gentlemen, give us a call and please contribute to KSFR and keep conversations like this on the air because I think they're very important to have. The number is 505-428-1393. One of the things that has been reiterated in pretty much everything I've read about water, whether it be in New Mexico, whether it be in Mexico, whether it be in Thailand, wherever you are, the vast majority of water that's used by people goes to agriculture. And then 10, maybe 15% goes to cities, houses, subdivisions, industry, all put together. Mm-hmm. So most of it goes to agriculture. Now, when you look at a place like New Mexico and you see dry reservoirs, dry streams, dry acequias, if we were to make different decisions, what kind of different decisions should be made? I mean, I can shorten my showers, but that's really not going to make a very big difference.
No.
What's going to make a difference is what?
Well, we're not going to be able to keep everybody happy. That's the bottom line. There's not enough water to go around continuing to do things as we've been doing them.
But some types of agricultural activity are very water intensive and not really the kind of things that if you were to start from scratch you would plan to do in the desert.
That's right. We can always shift to more water thrifty crops, and we can also keep moving along. We've already made a big start in this area to move toward more efficient water distribution systems when we do irrigate for agriculture. But the bottom line is that, you know, we're not going to be able to make everybody happy all the time because there just isn't going to be enough of the resource. And this is going to involve, eventually, maybe not right away, but eventually a kind of reshuffling of the deck. And a lot of people talk about climate change, you know, in the sense that it's a catastrophe that's waiting for us and, you know, the sky is falling and all that kind of stuff. And indeed, there are going to be really, really difficult challenges ahead. But in a sense, all those challenges are also opportunities. Because when it comes time to reshuffling the deck, maybe we can make a much better deal all the way around, a saner deal that supports the kind of society that we really believe in. And
yeah, because in times of trouble, human beings always make good rational decisions.
Yeah, well, not always, but we can hope. Tim DeChristopher was here just 1 or 2 weeks ago.
Yeah.
And made the point again and again that his generation, you know, he's, 31, 32, his generation knows that the world is going to be uncertain because the climate is changing. And if that's the case, he says, then that puts everything on the table. When everything's on the table and we really have to make some big changes, maybe we can attain higher levels of social justice, higher levels of equality of groups, higher level of all kinds of things. One of the takeaways of the book that I worked on, and I was kind of surprised to reach this conclusion, was that climate change, the challenges presented by climate change, are going to ask us to do a lot of the things that we should have been doing anyway.
Like
only
what?
they crank it up and make it more urgent.
Yeah.
Like building water resilience for our communities. And like thinning our forests and working toward healthier forest ecosystems. All the things that we know we ought to be doing, we need to do more of and faster because of climate change.
You know, it's interesting. We're talking to Bill DeBuies, and by the way, the number, we did have, I think, 1 or 2 phone calls, so thank you for calling, and keep on, please keep on calling and support the Radio Cafe, 428-1393. One of the things that I was thinking about is my mother lived through World War II in Germany, and when you live through a war and when you live through an extended period of not having enough food, not having enough gasoline to get from one place to another, not having enough of anything, conserving even matches, you know, using one match to light 7 candles in a row, doing it really fast, that kind of thing. You pass that on to your children. So I have much more of a sense of kind of thrift and economy about little things than maybe the next kid over who I went to elementary school with. And I have often wondered and sometimes had arguments at home over the dinner table whether that's a good thing or not, because sometimes you can be thrifty to the point of ridiculousness and kind of having an attitude about it, you know, sort of hard wooden pews, you know, superiority kind of thing. On the other hand, having learned that, you kind of know you can survive anything.
Yeah, and, you know, when it comes to making the adaptations necessary for climate change and those challenges in the future, I don't think anybody wants to have a society of neo-Puritans who are just scolding everyone all the time about using this or using that. But I do think that there's going to be a kind of winnowing effect, that the folks, you know, who are here, who go through this, are going to have to go through some inconvenience, and the folks who stick it out are going to be very, very good folks. They're going to be the best kind of neighbors who have some real resilience themselves.
You know, that is a a beautiful and hopeful thing. I have a bit of a kind of cynical attitude where I think the world is some percentage of evil mafiosos and some percentage of sages and good people, and then a whole lot of ordinary people who kind of go with the flow and do what everybody else is doing.
Well, if we get off onto corporate personhood and the idea of equating money with free speech, which the Supreme Court has lately encouraged us to do, then we can talk about some real evil afoot in the land.
428-1393. A couple of phone calls. Please keep this show on the air, and please keep, above all, KSFR on the air. So when you are deeply involved in environmental conservation movements, in things like the sow law, which may or may not be extinct already, but is so endangered by things like the Chinese appetite for rare species, for Chinese medicine and things like that, and for ivory, which is so depressing to me that it keeps me awake at night in a kind of despair. And you get a couple of those things piled up on top of each other. When you make your living and bring your attention to those things as your primary activity, how do you handle it psychologically? How do you stay sane? How do you stay not in a state of despair?
Well, I think that part of my job is to bear witness to my times. And so I want to be where the story is, if you will, and to try to understand what's going on in the world. And it can be pretty discouraging. I tell people that I'm an intellectual pessimist, because if you, you know, if the data don't depress you a little bit, you're not understanding the data. But at the same time, I'm a neurochemical optimist. And it may be just the serotonin talking, but, you know, every sunrise is beautiful. This planet is incredibly inspiring. And I love to be in situations where I get to observe wildlife and see new lands and feel the inspiration that the Earth can give us. So as long as there's that beauty out there, there's a lot to work for. And I think meaningful work is one of the greatest sources of meaning we can have in our lives. So as long as there's meaningful work to do, golly, let's just get out there and keep doing it.
We're talking to Bill DeBuise, 428-1393. I keep giving the phone number because I want to encourage people to call it. We have made a goal for $1,000. I don't know if we're going to come close. It's a bit of a slow afternoon, but, you know, whatever we make is good, and however many people put their names in the raffle to have lunch at the Zia here in Santa Fe with Bill DeBuise, so much the better. 428-1393. How did you become a writer, and how did you become a writer about nature and conservation and so on?
Well, growing up, I guess at some point I knew I wanted to write, and a writing teacher of mine, whom I studied with when I was an undergraduate at the University of North Carolina, had a theory that writers were made in their early adolescence, when they went through an exceptionally lonely period and sought solace in books and realized that the solace of a good story was something that they wanted to be able to produce and deliver somehow.
Is that true of you?
And I suppose it probably is. But, I mean, I knew I wanted to write from very, very early on, but I didn't know whether I would be, you know, good enough to make even a portion of my living doing that. But, you know, as one poet said to another, if you have to ask whether you should write, you probably shouldn't. If you simply feel the need to write, if writing, putting words on paper or on a computer screen, is the way you make sense of the world, the way you process your experience, your life, then you're going to write.
Very interesting. And so that was your experience, and Did you ever write fiction?
Yes, I've written a little bit of fiction. I can't say that it's very good. I've published just a handful of short stories here and there. And one of these days, I want to get back into it and try my hand at fiction again.
Who are your favorite Southwestern writers, fiction writers?
Well, I adore John Nichols, who's a friend and a great Southwesterner. Frank Waters is wonderful. Tony Hillerman. Ed Abbey, of course.
Of course.
They're all, you know, they're up there in the, at the top of the list.
428-1393, and I just got a message that we've got a few thank yous from the control room.
That's
Nick,
right.
What's going on?
All right, we would like to thank Bella Cloud.
Thank you.
And Merle Lefkoff.
Thank you, Merle. And I had an interesting conversation with Merle Lefkoff earlier today, who was talking about the whole question of wild horses on public lands and BLM roundup of horses. Is this an issue that you've been following?
Not closely. I can't claim to have followed it closely at all.
Because she was saying there are really two sides to this issue. On the one hand, these BLM roundups look really sort of awful and you don't want to round up horses for slaughter. On the other hand, they're destroying the watershed.
Oh, yeah.
And so what do you do? You put funding into it. Do we have funding? No.
Once upon a time, we had a great program going where feral horses, and, you know, you got to make a distinction between wild and feral.
Yeah,
and
these are
most
feral horses.
Instances, these are feral horses. I've seen so-called wild horses that had halters on, you know, which is to say that they were runaways from nearby ranches.
Right.
But once upon a time, these feral horses would be rounded up and taken to the state prison and gentled there by the inmates and broken. And it was a great thing for the inmates to be able to work with big animals like that and have a meaningful relationship with these creatures. It was a good thing all around, and they produced some pretty good, pretty tame, pretty rideable horses.
Let me guess, that went the way of all flesh when the prisons were privatized.
Well, certainly the private prisons never had any interest. I think that program died when Gary Johnson became governor.
Ah.
It was a frill that the governor didn't like.
A frill. I mean, we have had so many, a number of times on this program, the wonderful people from Horses for Heroes, which is a ranch down on Route 14, where they bring combat veterans with post-traumatic issues going on, post-combat issues, and, you know, instead of sitting in a nice shrink's office with pillows and Kleenex talking about their experience, they learn to put a saddle on a horse, and they how to ride it, and how to take care of it, and how to run a ranch, and little by little, they heal in this way that is so extraordinary and so beautiful.
Yeah, the relationship you can have with a 800 or 900 pound animal is with a horse is pretty marvelous, and it changes the horse and it changes the person. I mean, a lot of people invest a great deal of their emotional life into their dogs, and with horses you move up to yet another level of that kind of connection with another being.
Yeah, if you have the privilege of having horses, which I've never had, I certainly have the great privilege and honor of being an owner of three little, somewhat spoiled animals whom you have met. Bill DeGuise. 428-1393 is the number. We've just had a few calls this hour, and we would love your contribution, ladies and gentlemen, to really keep this program and keep this station on the air. So the 800, or the toll-free number is 866-907-5737, 866-907-KSFR. When you look back on the work that you've done and all the different books that you've written, do you see themes and continuities that emerge kind of in retrospect?
Yeah, absolutely. When I was just starting out, fresh out of college, I worked for a guy named Robert Coles, who was at the time pretty famous. He had been on the cover of Time magazine, and he had won the Pulitzer Prize, and that's one of the reasons he moved out to New Mexico and brought some research assistants, myself, Alex Harris, and another guy by the name of George Butler, we all came out to New Mexico with Coles in 1972. And I remember asking Coles, you know, is it ethical for a writer to write something and publish it and then write more or less the same thing and publish that somewhere else? And he looked at me and just broke out laughing. He says, "That's all we really ever do." So
interesting.
I mean, not to republish exactly the same thing, but you, of course, you see the same themes running through, and you see, hopefully, you see an arc of different understanding, different treatment, growing over the years, you can see in your own work, if you've got a body of work, you can see, you know, the evolution of your spirit over time.
And what does that look like specifically for you? I mean, do you go back and read some of your earlier work?
Well, not very often, but I'm going to, because UNM Press is going to republish my first book, Enchantment and Exploitation, in a new edition. So
good, you're coming on the radio.
Yeah, so I've got to go back and read Enchantment and Exploitation again, and it'll be I hope a good experience to see what I said those years ago.
Now, Enchantment and Exploitation sounds like a perfect book for a title about New Mexico.
It is. It's basically an environmental history and a social cultural history of northern New Mexico. And specifically of the southern Sangre de Cristo, the mountain world that we're on the edge of right here in Santa Fe.
Does it still, to you, well, I guess you're going to have to go back and reread it, but does it feel fresh? Do you think it's dated? Are you going to update it?
Yes. I'll write a new concluding chapter for it.
Ah.
And this is an opportunity. We don't get to correct ourselves very often in life, but this is an opportunity for me to take out some of the things that I don't quite agree with anymore and to put in some understandings that have developed for me and for a lot of people in the, what'll it be, 30 years since the book originally came out. It came out in 1985. I think it's going to reappear in 2015.
We're talking to Bill DeBuys. Do you consider yourself an activist?
Yes, I do, although I'm not out there on the streets and I'm not doing conservation land deals or advocating for policy changes in the way that I used to do. But I still feel that I am, and I think there are going to be a lot of times in the years ahead when we're all going to have to get out there and make a commitment and take a stand and stand up for some things.
How does that manifest for you? Like, where are you really taking a stand and putting yourself out there?
Well, I think where climate change is concerned, we should all be paying attention to organizations like 350.org. We have some great groups here in Santa Fe, the New Energy Economy.
Who just won a Pignon Award.
Which, did they?
Yeah.
I missed the awards last night because I was at the Paul Hawken talk.
Right.
These are excellent organizations. We need to give them support. And once in a while, I expect there'll be issues that come up where we really have to get out there and let our voices be heard.
The number is 428-1393. We've got 10 minutes left in this program, and we would like to get at least 5 more phone calls. So a couple of minutes for each person. Give a call right now, 428-1393, and support this station. It's very easy to do. You can make a contribution of a one-time contribution of, for example, $25 to put yourself in the raffle to have lunch with Bill DeBuys. And you can also make a sustaining contribution, which means that you make a contribution of, you know, $5, $10, $15, whatever, $20 a month, and you keep us going in that way. And we're grateful to everybody, and we're especially grateful to people who do that, because when you establish that kind of flow, it's like a regular precipitation, you know. Everybody who does that keeps the system hydrated, so to speak, here at KSFR for as long as they want to. They don't have to keep on re-pledging every fund drive. It just keeps on going until that person, you know, moves or wants to cancel or whatever. So we are especially grateful to people who do that. And if you just contribute what you can afford, I remember the first time I contributed to KUNM, it was $5 a month. And, you know, I didn't have too much work at that time, but I could still afford $5 a month. And so that's what we like to ask people to do, or a one-time contribution, whatever works for you. But please be part of this station and join the family. 428-1393. Bill DuBois, what is your relationship to public radio? I imagine you've done an awful lot of interviews as well as listening.
Well, and I do a lot of driving, and whenever I'm driving, I'm listening to public radio. I love KSFR here, KUNM. I live sort of on the borderland between KRZA, which comes out of Alamosa. And KSFR. I can receive both of them up at my home, so I listen to both with regularity. And I just want to say to the folks listening out there, do please call. Let's have lunch, and I promise I will behave myself.
Have you ever done anything else but behave yourself?
Yes, I've failed to behave myself on various occasions.
Really?
We're not going to go into that on the air, Mayor Charlotte.
We're not?
No.
You seem just
That'll be an entire other program. One day, long from...
It's going to be called Let's Misbehave with Bill DuBois.
There you go, yeah.
now I just want to know if it... No, I mean, I guess we all have had, how should we say... youthful enthusiasms of various kinds.
Yes. And let me just put it this way. I will never be a Supreme Court justice. I wouldn't be able to get through the background check.
Who would?
Yeah, right.
428-1393. The phones are oh so quiet. We do have people standing by. The city council meeting is going to be here in about 7 minutes. And so that is a big part of our democracy. 6 minutes. I actually listen to city council meetings sometimes for an extended period of time, and it is just so interesting to hear democracy in action. You know, people stepping up to talk about big issues like whether we should ban plastic bags in the city of Santa Fe, or small issues like whether an easement should be granted for something that goes onto the edge of your property or whatever. That really doesn't have anything to do with anybody but a tiny group of people. But they get out there and they've got their couple of minutes to talk. And it's a privilege for us to be able to broadcast that on KSFR.
Yeah, and you know, when you listen to that and you listen to... I mean, Santa Fe can be kind of a strange community, but it is a very progressive community. And a lot of things happen here that are really stimulating, really interesting. And you see it often reflected in those city council discussions. But I remember listening to my old friend Stu Udall, when he was still with us, speaking of great pride of Santa Fe. Here was a town where for chamber music you could fill a big hall, whereas in Tucson, where he had also lived at one time, city of 1 million people, you have to work hard to get the same number of people to turn out for chamber music or for a lecture on complexity at the Santa Fe Institute,
yeah,
or for an environmental event or for a Lennon talk, whatever. The stuff we've got going on here in Santa Fe is world class. I like to say that Santa Fe has world class arts with parking, which is kind of unusual. And I'll say that KSFR, in a way, is a reflection of all this diversity of thought and action and arts and so forth. And that's one of the reasons we need a vibrant public radio station here in town, is because we need to be able to communicate in our community about what's going on. And there's so much going on.
Very much so. I mean, I have been asked a number of questions over and over again by listeners, and one of those questions is, how do you program your show? And the answer is, to a large extent, I have to choose among the many, many offerings that this town has to figure out who to put on, because there are just so many choices and so many people in any given week, including the slowest week of February. There's a lot of people to put on the air. It's amazing.
That's so cool.
428-1393, 428-1393. We've got 3 minutes left. Let's get three calls in. This is the slowest hour I think I've ever been on the radio.
Oh, I'm afraid. I'm going to take
it
personally.
It's not you. No.
I'm going to take it personally. I'm going to go home and hang my head.
Oh, like a little dog.
Yeah, like a little dog. Just kind of sniffle in the corner.
Oh, no, it's not you. It's I don't know what it is. Listeners, what is it? Give us a call and tell us what you think about this station, because that's the other thing about this hour is about this week is that it is an opportunity for people to call and say how they feel about the station, what they're listening to, constructive criticism, a little bit of ranting if necessary. And we love to hear it. I love to hear it. I like it when people write back to the show. 428-1393. And Nick, what's going over there? What's going on over there at KSFR?
Not many calls.
Ah, well, okay. So we just have 2 minutes left. What should we, how do you want to leave us, Bill DeBuise, in the last 2 minutes?
Well, I think we just want to exit with everybody feeling so thankful to live in this community, to have a great radio station like KSFR, and to live in New Mexico, which for my money is the most beautiful state in the Union and a place with such wonderful diversity, such interesting people, so much good stuff going on, and not completely sacrificed to mammon as
that's right,
as some of our neighboring states might be.
Can we also talk about the artichoke and parmesan appetizer at the Zia Diner?
Well, that can be pretty good. I had a very late dinner at the Zia just last night.
Is that right?
Yeah, it is the location for comfort food in Santa Fe.
They have food late at night?
The kitchen was open and well after 9 o'clock when we got there.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, late at night is defined as after 9 o'clock.
Yeah, well, it may have been right around 9 o'clock, so I'm not going to, don't hold me to stating the Zia's hours.
The only thing wrong with the city, as far as I'm concerned, or the only major thing wrong, is good food after 9 p.m. But that's another topic. It's about time to go. Bill DeBuise is a writer, conservationist, author of many, many books, longtime New Mexican. In the background, we have the formation of a smoothie. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. Stay tuned for the Santa Fe City Council meeting and then all sorts of good stuff at KSFR. So please keep us in your thoughts and on your speed dial, 428-1393. And Bill DeBuise, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Oh, it was a lot of fun. Thank you, Mary Charlotte.